Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
I'm Contessa Brewer in for Brian Sullivan tonight. Right now on Last Call, reality versus Reddit. Donald Trump's social media company soars in its trading debut. And if you might believe this, what some are saying on Reddit right now. Growing fallout. The toll widens from today's Baltimore bridge collapse. We have the breaking developments. The battle for the Magic Kingdom. Nelson Peltz just scored a major win in his fight to try and get on Disney's board. More offices empty. So why are rents going up? We'll hear from industry giant Don Peebles. America's retirement crisis. BlackRock's Larry Fink rings the alarm. But there may be a fix. And airing it out, the NFL throws a new long ball in its push to streaming. We have all that and more over the next hour. Last Call is up right now. Good evening to you if you're on the East Coast. Good afternoon out West. Let's dive in, take a bite out of Apple. The global tech giant is getting rather mushy in starting 2024. Case in point, new data out of China today showing iPhone sales there in February dropped more than 30% from 2023. Now, look, we saw a similar slump in January. Last week, the Department of Justice announced it's suing Apple over the iPhone and over allegations of antitrust. The DOJ says Apple dominates the phone market, but it does so unfairly. And then ahead of Apple's annual developers conference in June, there's major concern the company is lagging behind in the AI race and missing out on the AI hype, driving tech companies higher in recent months. Apple stock is landing on a rocky road as well this year. So far this year, shares of Apple down 11%, while the S&P 500 has seen solid gains. In fact, looking at the past 5 months, the S&P 500 has jumped more than 24%. And look at Apple. It's down fractionally, but still. According to Bespoke, this hasn't happened with Apple since 1999. For a little perspective, that was before Apple had even launched the iPod. Apple's woes are leading to big-time Apple investor Gene Munster from Deepwater Asset Management to change his tune a bit. Here's what he said on Squawk Box when asked if his firm still owns Apple.
So we have different funds, and it has at different times, it's been in different funds, but currently we do not own it, but we continue to believe strongly and look for opportunities to do just that, to get back involved. This is one we continue to believe in longer term. We're just navigating what's going on with the March quarter.
Are Apple investors being too pessimistic, or is Apple's best days behind it? Let's ask our all-star panel. Joining me now, EMJ Capital founder and president Eric Jackson and Clio Capital managing director Sarah Kunst. Eric, I understand that you own Apple. Do you think there is still some room left to run?
Absolutely, Contessa. I think we're being way too pessimistic. I think out of all the Mag 7 names, after maybe Tesla, I think Apple's currently the most hated. For all the reasons that you mentioned off the top. But, you know, we've seen this motion picture before with Apple. There have been pullbacks, sometimes a lot sharper pullbacks than what we've seen. We're only down like 15% from like the November all-time highs for Apple. But we've certainly seen disappointing China numbers. It's not surprisingly, Tim Cook was there earlier this week. So I think it's at these times when there is a lot of pessimism floating around where it's proven to be smart to step in. So I have been accumulating over the last few weeks. I do think June WWDC event is going to be a catalyst. They released basically the title of that show today, basically that it's going to be an AI-centric show. So I say it's time to buy.
When you look at the pullback, Sarah, a lot of people might see this as an opportunity to take advantage of Apple shares right now. Are you one of them?
You know, I'm not buying in right now, but I certainly don't think that Apple is going away. I think that they have a solid business that's slowed. And it's interesting with the China piece of it, we're not hearing a lot about kind of the macro driver there, which is the Chinese government's telling a lot of employees and having a lot of private companies do the same. Hey, you can't bring Apple to work here. And certainly, you know, as the TikTok battle heats up, it's not going to be unlikely that we see some of that retaliatory behavior where China is probably going to crack down even further on groups like Apple and push, you know, to be buying local brands like Huawei. And so I think that China, the Apple story there is less about Apple and it is more about a much bigger geopolitical kerfuffle.
Okay, but if China's a problem for Apple, what about India? Because we keep having guests on CNBC who are talking about that economy being on fire. The population is growing, and they don't have Apple iPhones right now. They're largely not in the Apple ecosystem. Is there an advantage here, Eric, for Apple to pick up some of the China slack in India?
India has been a focus for them. They've talked about India for at least the last 5 years, and they've definitely been focusing on it. The Chinese middle class, though, Contessa, is just so much bigger and wealthier than India. It's an opportunity that Apple would really be shooting itself in the foot if it didn't stay fully focused there. So I think the ace in their back pocket is, does the Chinese government want a China for the Chinese? Only people can only buy Huawei phones? Or do they want foreign direct investment into China? Clearly they do. Clearly they've been upset with how much has been driven out of the country over the last couple of years. So it's not good business for them to see Apple flop in China. And I think they will be helpful.
Sarah, what would you want to see from Apple on the AI front to turn you into a believer and a buyer?
It's funny because Apple started a lot of what we think of as consumer AI now with Siri years ago, but the reality is we haven't seen a ton happen there. And I don't necessarily think it has to. The reality is that Apple is a hardware maker. Apple is very, very good at taking a tax on the App Store. Apple's never really been a big player in software. And so I don't know if we need to see Apple GPT. I think that partnering with groups like Google's Gemini is fine for them and makes sense for them. It's just a question of, you know, is the street, which is absolutely obsessed right now with AI, going to feel the same way?
Would it be Apple GPT or would it be iGPT? I'm not sure. We leave that to debate another day. Sarah, Eric, thank you. Appreciate it. Let's take a look at what happened to your money today. The Dow, the S&P, the 500, the NASDAQ look lower in the red. You've got the Dow off, but just fractionally, just hanging on into the red. Here's our studs and duds. The biggest winner of the day, McCormick & Co., up 10.5%. Spice Company benefiting from customers eating at home more. Ooh, biggest loser, UPS, down more than 8%. Investors just not impressed with the company's forecast for 2026. And let's get a look at the futures here. All three ticking higher as we speak in the green by fractions of a percent. Up next, the rapidly mounting toll of the Baltimore Key Bridge collapse. We'll head live to the scene. Plus, Reddit faces reality in the wild trading debut of Donald Trump's Truth Social. Stay with us.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation. Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
Welcome back to Last Call. These are the shocking images of the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse in Baltimore. It happened in the early hours of the morning. A massive container ship rammed into the bridge. Six construction workers who had been fixing potholes are still missing. Divers and emergency workers on helicopters and boats are continuing to search for them. President Biden says the federal government will pay for the cost to rebuild the bridge, as Maryland Governor Wes Moore declared a state of emergency. CNBC's Eamon Javers is live at the scene now. Look, this is a big blow for Baltimore, I understand. Eamon, give me a sense of the consequences.
Contessa, it absolutely is a big blow for the city of Baltimore and for the state of Maryland. Take a live look now at the ship, which you can see there, the container ships, the containers still stacked 6-7 deep on the deck of that ship as it's wedged under the bridge. This is the Francis Scott Key Bridge, Route 695, if you've ever driven through this area. And there you can see the wreckage of the bridge still pinning the bow of that ship down. So the ship has not moved ever since the incident about 1:30 in the morning this morning. I just spoke to Senator Ben Cardin a short time ago, the senator from Maryland. He told me a couple of key pieces of information that they're getting briefed on behind the scenes here. For the first, he said there is a set of divers that have been going down below the surface here to look at that wreckage because there's concern that the wreckage itself is not stable and that the cargo containers on the deck of the ship are not stable. He said there's no indication now, despite the impact, that the ship will sink, that its hull has been breached in such a way that it could sink. But that situation could change because the ship is still being buffeted by tide and by current here in the Patapsco River. He also said that the question remains now whether or not the ship can be returned to port at any point soon, given the stability of that wreckage, or if they're going to have to unload those containers that you see on the deck there in the water. That would be a very complicated process, he said, with specialized equipment, and that could add to the time here that it would take to get this wreckage cleared up, to get the ship removed, and ultimately to get the harbor back in action. We heard from Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg earlier today, and what he was talking about here was the economic impact that this will have, and it will be massive. Take a listen.
There is no question that this will be a major and protracted impact to supply chains. It's too soon to offer estimates on what it will take to clear the channel and reopen the port.
Contessa, this is still an active search and rescue scene. Officials have been insisting throughout the day, despite the length of time, despite the cold water, despite all of the conditions here, they say they are still looking for those six individuals who went missing this morning. They were part of a road crew that was filling potholes on the bridge. They say authorities were able to get a warning to police to stop traffic on the bridge just before the impact. That saved a lot of lives, they said, because as many vehicles were not on the bridge as otherwise would have been, but those six individuals are still missing, and the Coast Guard is still out here, Contessa, and they are still looking.
I can't imagine the hazard for divers, too, to be down underneath looking at the hole and all of that while the proximity and the potential for more collapse to happen. In the meantime, if you hear Secretary Buttigieg say it's too soon to think of the timeline for reopening the port, what does that mean for port traffic? Like, what's being affected?
Well, look, I mean, there's FedEx is here, Amazon is here, a lot of automobiles are delivered here, more than 800,000 automobiles delivered to this port in 2023. So there's a lot of commerce that comes through this area. All of that is being impacted. There's no shipping, as you can tell from that wreckage is blocking the entire channel here. So there is no shipping coming in and out of the Port of Baltimore at this point. All the ships that were in port are stuck there. All the ships that were out in the Atlantic Ocean are having to be rerouted. All of that is frozen. And what Senator Cardin was saying is they're trying to get their arms around just how long it will take simply to reopen the channel here and get shipping back up and running, not to mention the length of time it will take to reconstruct that bridge. That could be years before they're able to get traffic flowing in a normal way around the city of Baltimore again, Contessa.
Eamon, thank you for bringing us the latest there from Baltimore. Appreciate it. Still ahead on Last Call, a Reddit frenzy meets financial reality. Will Truth Social investors face a rude awakening? Stay with us.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
Tomorrow's news tonight, and first up, more details about Adam Neumann's bid to buy back WeWork. We told you yesterday he made at least a $500 million bid to purchase WeWork out of bankruptcy. Now we know the financing or support from creditors is still not clear. CNBC spoke with multiple people familiar with the matter. Withum Capital is one of Neumann's potential financial backers, but they told CNBC their offer is preliminary. And WeWork declined to comment. We're still waiting on more details. Next up, Merck shares in the green after hours. The FDA just approved the drug Winrevair, designed to treat a rare, deadly form of high blood pressure that affects the lungs. Roughly 40,000 people in the United States are impacted by the condition, and Winrevair is the first drug to treat the root cause. In 2021, Merck paid $11.5 billion for the company that developed the drug, Acceleron Pharma. As you can see, the share's up almost 5%. A deal in the restaurant industry, the privately held Safflower Holdings, the parent company of Benihana, you know, famous for its teppanyaki table, is selling to fine dining restaurant owner One Group Hospitality for $365 million, including debt. According to research firm Technomic, Benihana is the 103rd largest chain by U.S. restaurant sales. And of course, it's known not only for that hibachi style of cooking, but also for how many shrimp can land in one's mouth. And finally, GameStop posting earnings after the bell, and the stock, it is tumbling after hours, off by 15%. The company reported weaker than expected revenue compared to the same period a year ago. It also announced it cut a number of jobs to lower costs, though it didn't say exactly how many. From one meme stock to another, Trump Media and Technology Group taking off today. It made its trading debut on the NASDAQ under the ticker DJT. It skyrocketed by 50% at one point. Eventually, it closed up 16%. But now get this. It has a market cap of roughly $8 billion based on an undiluted share count. That is more than the value of the New York Times. DJT has triggered a frenzy on social media and among retail traders. Reddit's Wall Street Bets forum and on X, they've just been inundated with posts. A lot of users writing things like, and I'm quoting here, "Thanks, DJT," or "Let's go to the moon." But all this hype runs up against some stark reality. And what exactly lies underneath the company's hood? Take the Trump Media's website investor relations page. It is minimalist. No snazzy presentations. It has just a simple disclosure. And then you dig around a little bit, and eventually you can find the most recent financial disclosures filed with the SEC. Dig a little further, and here are some of the key findings that you'll see. Trump Media generated $3.4 million in revenue, million with an M, through the first 9 months of 2023. And over that same period, the company lost $49 million. Cash and assets on hand, $1.8 and $2.9 million respectively, with some $60 million in liabilities. Again, millions. The market is valuing today Trump Media at about $8 billion. Donald Trump, of course, now owns 60% of the stock. He can't sell his shares for the first 6 months due to lockup provisions unless the board, on which his son sits, grants him approval. Let's bring in CNBC contributor and author of the Substack newsletter, Herb on the Street, Herb Greenberg. Hi, Herb.
Hello, Contessa.
I've laid out for you there sort of what the hype is and what the reality is. How do you navigate the discrepancy?
Well, you navigate it because this is the most overhyped meme stock since the meme stock mania, with one big difference, and that is this is, back then, they kept going higher. Now you've got the buy on the rumor, sell on the news, or at least that's what it appears to be. I think in any other universe, in any other world, with any other sort of name or person associated with it, this would be a penny stock. And that is not, you know, that's not a good thing to say, because, you know, this company doesn't deserve this valuation. And I suspect, unless something radically changes, or for some reason some people are pushing this thing up, or whatever short squeeze occurred today stops occurring, this stock will probably do what other SPACs did, and that was will be, I would suspect, fall below their de-SPAC price of around $10.
You know, the interesting part of that is that while you can look at the discrepancy between the financials and what the company's worth in the equities market right now, there is reason to think that when there's a lot of hype around a company, it can fuel a company's growth. We've seen it with other meme stocks. I cover gambling. When you see companies that are still losing money, but their equity share price is soaring, sometimes there's a reason behind that. Do you think that some of the political fervor around Donald J. Trump actually has the possibility of making the company valuable?
You know, that's a great question, Contessa, because you could argue that actually that works against it, based at least on its business model. Its business model relies heavily, based on their filings, on advertising. And we know from even just looking over at X/Twitter that, you know, advertisers don't like polarization because that could affect them. So this company has to do something to pull in advertisers. And that's been tough. And when you become a political animal, you know, that can keep advertisers away, and that would keep revenue away. And that means this theoretically is a dubious business model. Look, in the best of times, social media is a very difficult business. You can even look at Reddit, whose stock is doing fantastic. And if you had to bet on one, obviously you'd go to Reddit. Reddit has, what is it, $800 million in revenue? They have real users. They have a lot of users. This company doesn't have many users. So you have to basically have proof. And on some of these companies where there's a lot of hype, yeah, they grow into their valuation. Often, though, if it's really, you know, held up on stilts, the stilts get wobbled.
We were just showing their members of the Trump media board. If you're listening on the radio, they include Devin Nunes, Eric Swider, Donald J. Trump Jr., the president's son, on through Linda McMahon, who, of course, was involved with WWE for a time. When you're looking at these board members, they're allies of the former president. If he has a lockup and it says you can't sell this stock for 6 months, but he needs the money, how likely are they to allow him to sell it? And can the market absorb that kind of big impact?
Well, in terms of him selling, the likelihood, obviously, when you see a friendly board like that, you want to say, I mean, I don't know what the likelihood is. I assume the likelihood is high. But if you have those kind of shares flooding the market, you know, he owns 60% of the stock. You have those shares flooding into the market. That dilution is generally means the shareholders who own stock today will own, you know, less of the company. And usually when you see that happen, stocks fall. I mean, look, people look at companies, you know, like Arm Holdings, which, you know, SoftBank owns 90%. And the big question is, what happens if SoftBank sells? Well, the same thing is here. What happens if Donald Trump sells? In theory, you know, if the biggest holder is selling his stock, no matter what the reason, he's selling his stock. That's a signal to investors, if that much stock was to come out, that this stock isn't as valuable as it appears to be.
We
at
wait.
Least not to investors, more to him.
We wait and we watch. Herb Greenberg.
We do.
Thank you. Sure. Coming up, it may be the strangest trend yet in the crunch for commercial real estate. We're going to hear from industry giant Don Peebles. That's next. Plus, a potential fix for America's retirement crisis from BlackRock's Larry Fink. Stay with us. So glad you're watching Last Call. Despite soaring vacancy rates and a looming default crisis, office rents are going up. A lot of owners are doing everything in their power to avoid lowering prices because rent is often used to determine property value. According to data firm CoStar Group, the average asking price for office rent in the U.S. is higher now than it was just before the pandemic and the rise of work from home. So when will office rents start reflecting office vacancies? With me tonight for more is Peebles Corporation CEO and Chairman Don Peebles. Don, thank you for being here on Last Call.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so talk to me a little bit about why we see this big disconnect, and when, I mean, if there's so many vacant offices, when do they either lower the rents or start to default on the loans and then somebody else picks it up and decides what to charge for rent?
Well, I think rental rates are not the real story here. The real story is occupancy rates. Occupancy rates are down significantly, 40% in New York City, 50% in Washington, D.C. The only bright spots are places like Miami, Dallas, Austin, where the markets are stronger. So it's more about demand. And I think rents are going to hover at the same level of asking rates, and essentially they're unchanged. But what will happen is ultimately these buildings will get, you know, fewer and fewer income streams coming as these tenants who are still paying rent but not using the space, as they give the space back when the leases are running up.
Okay, then one thing that strikes me here about the markets that are hot for office buildings and those that are not is tax rates. If you take a look at New York City, and listen, I apologize to everybody else living in other parts of the country that I'm going to be a local news person here for a second. But when you look at New York City and the congestion pricing that is coming down, it affects not only people who would be coming in to occupy offices, which a lot of bosses seem to want, but also people who live in New York City. How do you solve a vacancy crisis if you are taxing everyone that you want to be back in and occupying these buildings?
Well, I think that you've raised a very important element here. That's the biggest challenge New York is facing right now. New York City was fundamentally challenged even before the pandemic because it's one of the highest taxed cities in the country. It is one of the costliest places to do business and the costliest place to live in the United States. And so as a result, businesses were already relocating to Florida, Texas, Tennessee, Arizona, and other Sunbelt areas around the country where there are better tax environments, more pro-business environments, and also a better quality and lower cost of living.
What are successful landlords doing to keep offices occupied?
I think that they're trying to offer newer buildings are doing much better. So new buildings like in New York City, to stay local, you have Hudson Yards has done exceptionally well. One Vanderbilt next to Grand Central Station, a brand new skyscraper doing exceptionally well, getting over $200 a square foot in rents, offering unparalleled amenities, access to transportation, high quality space for the premium tenants. Those buildings will continue to do well. Those are the ones that are going to attract tenants. New buildings, and I wouldn't be surprised to see more new buildings in New York City, more new buildings in places like San Francisco. But I think Miami will also continue to lead the way in terms of rent growth. Rents have doubled in Miami since the pandemic.
And in these other places, do you think that we're going to see an onslaught of defaults?
I think so. I think what we're seeing it now, what you have is some of the flagship owners, the Blackstones of the world, the Brookfields of the world, they're giving properties back to their lenders already. They're trying to clear the decks so that they can start buying on an opportunistic basis. Washington, D.C. is going to get decimated. It's already begun. But by the third and fourth quarter of this year, you're going to see some accelerations of many large office buildings being given back to their lenders. San Francisco's already been happening. Los Angeles already happening. So we're going to see a lot more. But the bright spot's going to be Miami. The bright spot also, I think, will be Charlotte, North Carolina. I think that we'll see a lot there. And I think San Francisco's kind of bottomed out, and now's the time to look to buy there.
Meanwhile, it looks like you're coming to us from the Birch Grove in Aspen. Don Peebles, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Well, from Blackstone to BlackRock, one crisis to another, you've got BlackRock CEO Larry Fink highlighting America's growing social security crisis in a letter to shareholders. He called the idea of retiring at 65, quote, a bit crazy. He joined Mad Money earlier.
In coming years, we're going to be doubling the number of people over 65 years old, and we're not preparing society for that.
So how does America answer a growing crisis, a higher retirement age, more entitlements? How does that affect the ballooning national debt? With me tonight for more is Bear Traps Report founder Larry McDonald. He's also the author of the new book, How to Listen When Markets Speak, Risks, Myths, and Investment Opportunities in a Radically Reshaped Economy, just released today. Congratulations on the book. When he's ringing that bell and saying, look, we are heading for a crisis, do you just see it loud and clear? Do you think that we're ignoring the telltale warning signs?
Well, first of all, thank you to you and CNBC. I've been part of the family a long time, and this is a big day. Thank you. This is a hubris moment in Washington. It's both parties. You know, think about maybe 10 years ago, we had an austerity moment on the Hill. Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk to different senators and congressmen behind the scenes, they're just still in spend mode. And it's hubris. It's complacency. And we are talking about in the third quarter of this year, right ahead of the election, issuance is going to pick up. That means bond sales. And we're heading for what's called a Liz Truss moment, or a moment where the bond market body slams Capitol Hill.
But if you have leaders, and I think this is members of both parties, who they have to be in Congress, they have to be elected every 2 years. They're on a constant campaign. If you have a president who believes that young voters are crucial to winning another election and wants to give them what they think that they need, it doesn't seem like looking at a ballooning federal deficit or what's to come when Social Security has to take care of people for far longer. It's just not a popular thing to worry about.
True. And that's one of the things we talk about in the book, is that democracies typically have a life cycle of about 275 years, depending on which democracy you look at. And what happens is when voters realize that they can drain the treasury at the expense of, you know, a proper fiscal foundation, that puts more stress. And politicians try to buy votes. And so this year, we have to refinance almost $11 trillion of debt.
I mean, the chart that shows the federal debt that's held by the public as a percentage of GDP is really astonishing, and especially the projections for where it could go by 2054. How do we solve it?
Well, think about like the last 10 years. We had a lot of the Chinese were buying a lot of bonds, Japanese were buying a lot of bonds. But there's so many bonds for sale, and now China's buying more gold and less treasuries. And so essentially what's going to happen is, especially toward the right now we're doing quantitative tightening at the Fed, and that's essentially lowering the balance sheet. The Fed's going to have to step in. There's going to be massive political pressure on the Fed to step in and start buying bonds again, quantitative easing, and that's around the third quarter of this year. That will probably weaken the dollar, and that's what's going to get you into a spectacular, this is the investment opportunity of our lifetimes. It's all in our book, When Markets Speak. We're talking about trillions of dollars migrating from financial assets, you know, stocks and things like that, to more hard assets, back toward commodities.
Okay, and when you're looking at the fiscal leadership that's required to sort of break us out of where we're standing on this cliff edge, how do you encourage the nation's leaders to take that action?
Well, you know, if President Trump was looking at me right now, I'd say, listen, you're talking about tax cuts, extending those tax cuts, you know, his tax
yes.
cuts that they passed. If they extend them, that's another $3.5 trillion of spending, essentially, or bonds they're going to have to sell. And then they're talking about corporate tax. So essentially, if you're trying to buy votes, you can do it two ways. You can promise tax cuts or promise lots of spending. And both parties are kind of doing both of that. And so Trump's going to run into a problem with the bond market if he goes that path.
Individuals watching only have two choices. They have a choice with their vote, and they have a choice for how to manage their own portfolios and their own money. Is there a lesson that you take away from the big macro picture to the micro picture?
Well, in our book, When Markets Speak, what we talk about is, think of this number. There's $22 trillion in the NASDAQ 100, 22. In the entire energy sector and metals and all of the commodities you need to rebuild our grid structure in America, our electric grid, yeah. all the things we talk about in the book, there's only about $3 trillion worth of stocks in that group versus $22 trillion in just tech, essentially. So we're talking about, for people watching us right now, your 401k wants to reposition into more hard asset stocks and mutual funds versus the crowded trade. That's the $22 trillion that's all basically in 12 companies.
The book is called How to Listen When Markets Speak. Larry, great to see you.
Thanks,
Thank you
Contessa.
For coming in. I appreciate you. Coming up, Nelson Peltz just won a major backing in his fight to get on Disney's board. We have that still ahead. We have a bonus Tomorrow's News Tonight, and it's a big update on the Disney board battle. A short time ago, proxy advisor Egan Jones said Disney stockholders should support billionaire activist Nelson Peltz's nominees to the board, saying it would force the company to, quote, listen to new and different ideas. So far, after hours, shares of Disney, they're not really moving on the news, just slightly in the red. But investors should keep a close eye on this one. Last week, two other proxy advisors split their support between Peltz and Disney CEO Bob Iger. And how does that affect the Disney board battle? Perhaps more importantly, how does it affect you if you're a Disney shareholder? Let's ask Tom Rogers. He's the executive chairman of Orbit Gaming and Entertainment, also the first president of NBC Cable and the founder of CNBC. It's great to see you today.
Great to be here, Contessa. Thank you.
What do you make of Egan Jones siding now and saying, yeah, Nelson Peltz should be on the board? How does that influence what we'll see play out next week?
Well, clearly Peltz has got some momentum there. If I had to bet, I would think that Iger will eke this out. But clearly there's some sentiment that another voice on the board that isn't necessarily in line with all of management's thinking is something that Disney could use.
What do you think that Bob Iger should be taking away from the fact that those who are backing him are like-minded friends and let's just call them friends and family? Like he's got a lot of opposition for people who want to see more diversity of thought in that boardroom.
Well, he does, but he also has substantial support. Jeff Sonnenfeld, who you've had on this air, has laid out the case very articulately for why Bob Iger should win this proxy battle. And there's plenty of support for the record that Bob has had at Disney. But thinking Bob has done a good job is not necessarily inconsistent with the fact that you might think the board has been too deferential toward him. Case in point, the Fox acquisition, which was really not a good acquisition, and certainly Iger had many good acquisitions. The board's awarding him substantial sum for what was otherwise a bad acquisition, some might point to as evidence that the board is too close to management and not providing the kind of oversight it should. So, I think you can have both thoughts be true here. Mm-hmm. Iger is a very good CEO, and that the board may be been too differential and could use some new voices there.
Okay, so what's your bet? Do you think Nelson Peltz gets a seat on the board next week?
I think it's very close. I think the movement in the stock recently probably helps Iger, although I'm sure there are those who think it's been moving up because of the likelihood, what they may feel is the likelihood of Peltz getting on the board. And if he doesn't, maybe the stock drops back down. When you look at Iger's performance relative to other legacy media companies like Warner Brothers and Paramount, it's not hard to make the case that Disney has well outperformed them, and that may give him the fuel he needs to win this. But I think Peltz clearly has some momentum here, so it's going to be close.
Okay, let's get some thoughts on the world of media and sports now. We've learned that NBC's Peacock will be the exclusive streaming platform for the NFL's opening week Friday night game. It will feature the Philadelphia Eagles, though we don't know who they'll face. We do know the game will be played in Brazil, the first ever in South America, Latin America becoming very important. And Peacock has carried two exclusive games last season, including the wild card showdown between the Chiefs and the Dolphins. And we saw this recent report, 71% of the users who purchased Peacock for that game remain subscribers. So, look, is it just a matter of time until every game is exclusive to streaming? And doesn't, in this case, the stickiness, does it matter?
Well, I don't think we'll see every game exclusive to streaming for a long time. What we are seeing is more focus on getting things on a broadcast network in terms of sports and getting more games over on the streaming side, which has the effect of being able to reinforce the breadth of reach that the leagues want when it comes to sports, but at the same time allows media companies to use the popularity of the NFL to drive audience for their streaming platforms, which they badly need to do. When you look at the NFL, which is a unique property in and of itself, because 93 of the top 100 shows on television last year were NFL games, you're dealing with a totally unique property. So allowing media companies to drive their need to expand their streaming platforms is obvious, and this is just a continuation of it. For NBC, it's a phenomenal way to kick off the NFL season, to have exclusive games on Thursday night, Friday night with this Brazil game, and Sunday night. That's a hell of a promotional window to have at the beginning of a new television season. So,
and given that it's part of my employer, a rising tide lifts all boats. That's my view on it, Tom. Thank you.
Thanks, Contessa.
Coming up, the group that's really leading the post-COVID comeback for businesses. New findings you'll want to see ahead.
Female CEOs are about 10% of CEOs. And in the startup space, we actually get less than 2% of dollars from VC funding. And we have to celebrate women. Women tend to actually be more behind the scenes. We prefer to focus on building companies than to be in the spotlight. But little girls won't be able to know that they can become CEOs and founders and executives and anything else that they want to be unless they see us and they see what they could become.
My friend Brian Sullivan may be off, but sometimes something is so random, it is so interesting that we have to continue to do the RBA. Tonight, that has to do with Meta. The social media giant officially paid out a dividend for the first time ever. The amount? 50 cents a share. It's a yield of about 0.4% based on today's close. But one shareholder in particular is seeing a major windfall, and that's Meta CEO and co-founder Mark Zuckerberg. Zuck currently owns about 350 million shares of Meta. So at 50 cents a share, it means he has roughly $175 million just from the dividend payout today. That's not too shabby. The pandemic upended operations for small businesses across the country. But from those challenges, entrepreneurs did what they do best. They look for opportunity. And a new report finds women are leading the charge. CNBC's Kate Rogers joins us with more. Hi, Kate.
Hey there, Contessa. The data shows that women seized the opportunity to launch ventures during the pandemic at nearly double the rate of men. Data from Wells Fargo show the number of businesses owned by women from 2019 through 2023 were up nearly 14%. That's about double the rate we saw for men. Growth rates for revenue and employment are even higher for businesses that are owned by Black and African American women, with their business growth rates outpacing the overall markets. Now, this is key as businesses owned by women and minorities were disproportionately impacted early on in the pandemic and were less likely to receive initial rounds of PPP funding. Ruby Taylor, who's a former school social worker, runs the Financial Joy School, which aims to close the financial wealth gap and create a new generation of Black investors. Taylor has overcome not only funding challenges to launch her business, but also a traumatic brain injury in 2012 that drastically altered her life. She learned about long-term investing from the parents of a former student and got the idea to launch her business from there.
When my financial situation changed, I began to invest. And then I saw my money grow. I'm like, this is so dope. So I am on a mission to create a financially equitable world where everybody can build generational wealth no matter your income.
Ruby graduated from Milestone Circles, which is a program presented by the NASDAQ Entrepreneurial Center, sponsored by Wells Fargo. It helps owners find new pathways to funding. So very key, Contessa, in overcoming some of these barriers for owners as they look to grow. Back over to you.
That's part of the reason why the programs matter, and that parents of a student helped her out there. Pretty remarkable. Kate, thank you.
Thank you. And of course,
we're celebrating CNBC's inaugural Changemakers, Women Transforming Business List. It's coming up in New York at an event on April 18th. If you'd like to learn more, you can go to cnbc.com/changemakers or scan this QR code there. And amazing to see. Okay, if you're feeling lucky tonight, you still have time to buy a Mega Millions lottery ticket. The jackpot is up to $1.1 billion. It's the fourth largest ever for the Mega Millions. That drawing set tonight for 11 p.m. Eastern. And in case you're wondering, the odds of winning the billion-dollar prize is one in a little more than 302 million. But here's what I know about statistics. If you don't buy a ticket, you won't win. Thanks for watching Last Call. I'll see you back here tomorrow. Shark Tank is next.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.